It is Saturday, July 22nd, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today, we're doing Geek News and, of course, taking your calls with questions and comments. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our show, we talk about the geek news of the week. And during the second half of the show, of course, we'll welcome you to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you want. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can contact us now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Again, that's geekspeak.org. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks John Tracy, technical support engineer at Surf Control, Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, and Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lyle.
So today we're going to do a whole bunch of geek news, kind of cover what's been happening in the week of geek, if it were, and during the second half we'll be taking people's calls. Let's start out with Mr. Miles Elam.
In the news, this was actually more than a week ago, you had Dell at a computer show with what amounted to an exploding laptop, or rather a laptop that was energetically jetting flame out from...
Seems like an explosion.
Right. Well, it wasn't so much an explosion as just a fire that just kept burning and burning and burning, and not much you could do about it. This was coming from its battery, the lithium-ion battery inside of it. As it turns out, as the story has unfolded, is that Dell knew about... a dozen burned laptops over the course of the last 2 years.
So why did this one make the news? If this has happened before.
Well, no, that's the thing, though. They knew about it, but they never actually mentioned it.
Kind of sly.
So now they're saying they're announcing a recall of 22,000 notebooks
Why are they doing this now, specifically? If they've known about it for a while, what's caused them to have to deal with it?
Because someone had it on video and camera.
This one happened publicly.
Publicly, okay. And some trade show or something, right?
With a lot of people around. Where the laptop was just sitting on a desk and all of a sudden erupting in flames.
Wow.
And I do have to backtrack a little bit. They announced the recall last year,
right.
Oh, okay.
But this was 2 years before that recall. There were laptops catching on
fire. Basically, recently it hit the news because it's like so shocking the laptop can do this. And in reality, Dell knew about it and has dealt with it from a legal perspective a while ago.
Right.
So how do you know if you've got a Dell laptop that can just explode or catch on fire?
That's a fine question. I actually don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But it would be anyone who has, it would be someone who has a lithium-ion battery, but it may be specific models.
Or models and everything, yeah.
Depending upon the heat dissipation.
In any case, you should research it, especially since people leave, it's not uncommon to leave your laptop on while you're not around.
Yeah, if your laptop in general gets very hot, I mean, a lot of laptops will get warm, so that's kind of... kind of off there, but if you have a Dell laptop that gets very hot, it would be good to look up on their website and see
and
if they have any information.
Yeah, definitely, and get it done. All right, thank you very much, Miles. John, hi.
Hi, morning. I just want to do a little blurb while we're talking about technological foibles out there. I have a Gmail account, and I just recently found out that if you have a username with a dot in it, you can have a username with a dot in it, but you can't have an email address. Well, you can have an email address with a dot in it.
Wait, back up.
Google doesn't.
What's going on? What's been happening to you? Your Gmail account is a free, very large mailbox web email account.
From Google, right?
From Google.
Okay. And it's nice because you get a couple megabytes. Right now I get 2,700 some odd megabytes of storage up there.
A couple gigs.
2 gigs.
Yeah. I have everyone send any pictures that are being sent to me, I have them sent to there because there's so much storage and they have no restriction on size. Well, 10 gigs.
And I think you do still have to get invited. So,
yes, you do.
You have to know someone that
and if anyone wants an invite, I think I've got 100 left.
But that may be one of their efforts in combating spam, because spam on the same system is really hard.
Right.
So this one is filter spam. Yeah. No one really invite. Like, if someone invites a spammer, then you take out the account that spawned it as well.
So. Right. But you know, if you're interested in getting a Gmail account, and you can convince the geeks that we should invite you. You're welcome to let us know. Just go to geekspeak.org and fill in a form. I wonder.
Unless you're a spammer.
Oh, great. Now
we're
going to have like 2,000 messages in our inbox.
I don't think it's that high of an issue. But in any case, when you do make your Gmail account, don't put a dot in it.
Right.
Or if you do, understand.
A dot to the rest of the world, meaning a period.
I don't still get it, John. What's going on?
I was sort of receiving mail for somebody else, and the mail was coming into John Tracy.
And your address is John.Tracy?
Yes.
Now everyone knows.
That's fine. I don't care. Like I said, I got a room up there, a lot of room up there, and their spam filtering's pretty good.
Okay.
So I started getting mail for somebody else, and I was a little freaked out about this because I was thinking, if I'm getting mail for JohnTracy@gmail.com, are they getting mail for John.Tracy@gmail.com? So I contacted him, and he said, yes, I have been. But I didn't ask for any specifics, so I'm not sure if he was telling the truth or not.
Right, and then all the notes that are going... Well, you clearly had messages for John Tracy. And so you made the assumption, of course, very accurately, that for some reason Gmail takes away the periods, and since there's an account called John.Tracy, there's probably an account called John Tracy, and you're both getting copies via email.
And up on Google's Help Center, I found a little blurb about Gmail does not recognize dots as characters with a username.
Which is actually kind of a cool feature. You can add dots into any Gmail account and still send it to the person that has that account without the dots.
Right.
But the fear, of course, is that if there's two usernames and they can both receive the same messages, that's a problem.
Turns out Google doesn't allow that. So if someone went up to register as John Tracy, that would be rejected because John.Tracy is already registered. So
that's good.
Yeah.
Okay, why were you getting John Tracy? Or who's this John Tracy character?
It turns out his email address is actually John D. Tracy. But people were sending it to John Tracy, so
taking
I was receiving
it.
Yeah, so it was simply a case of mistyped. But it was sent to John Tracy, which was not my address.
So it should have bounced.
Which was going to you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so, it should have bounced as invalid user.
Well, I would say that it's kind of nice that you know now that you can use John Tracy as an email address instead of John.Tracy.
Yeah. But Drew is absolutely right, because email should be a specific character-sensitive... Yeah. Dots included.
Well, there's a feature in Gmail, another feature that's similar to this, which I actually like quite a bit, and that is that you can append a word in front of your email address for Gmail with a plus.
Yeah.
And then that gets ignored and you still get it, but it still shows up and you can filter off of it. So now if you're signing up at some bank account or something, or some place that might be giving you spam, you can put that extra word in the front, like Bank of America plus John Tracy at Gmail, and then whenever you get messages from them, you know it's from them. And if you start getting spam on that, you know that that company had a problem. And that's a big issue with email addresses. Companies have large databases of email addresses.
It's kind of wild. It's like saying your address is 900 Pine Street and you're getting mail delivered for 900 Pine Avenue.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, the dot in an email message, a dot's not a unique character. It's not an email address. Yeah, it's in the front part of the email address. I think that it's pretty common for people to have different characters in the front go to the same box. Miles, you want to support me on this? What's the status on a dot in the front of an email address? Is it a common thing across all email addresses, or is it just a filtering situation for Gmail?
That's a fine question that I don't know the answer to because I was working on the website.
It actually, most mail servers accept a dot as a character. So therefore, if you have a dot in a name, that's a unique name.
Yeah.
That's unique from someone else. I agree with Drew. I think they should have gotten a 550 error saying invalid user. This user does not exist. That way the sender knows this message did not go through. This message was not received by its intended recipient. I think that's important because it turns out he's not really receiving my mail because he only receives stuff for John D. Tracy.
Right.
I'm receiving his mail, though, because people are sending it to him. His name is John Tracy also.
With the intent of sending it to him,
but I'm receiving it, and they don't know.
But what if they sent it to Johnny Tracy? What if someone's sending messages to Johnny.Tracy? You're not going to get those. You know, people think that maybe it's you, not that anyone calls you Johnny.
If the guy has an address registered as Johnny Tracy with no dot, he'd be getting the messages.
That's right. I mean, that's true with any email. If I send it to your...
No, that's true. But
so the question is that the issue is the dot. So it's... It does add confusion. It's probably not necessary.
I'm not sure why they want to do this specific.
I agree. It's weird.
Okay. Has Google said anything about this? Have you asked them or said anything?
They have a FAQ about it.
Yeah. This is their FAQ is that, yes, that's true. Google does not recognize dots within the character name. Here's how you can change your reply to address so it
functions.
Yeah, so it functions.
But the username is still unique. So in any case, thank you very much, John, for that. Mm-hmm. Hi, Drew.
Good morning. So this is pretty interesting. Home voice over IP is growing, and voice over IP is internet telephone service over the internet. So you get rid of your what they call POTS, the plain old telephone system, your copper line that normally you have, and you quit paying, what is the phone company around here, GTE, AT&T? And you quit paying them, and your telephone service goes away on the copper, and you start using your telephone over your home network, which is connected mm-hmm. via DSL or cable broadband. Home voice over IP subscribers are adopting at a phenomenal rate, growing from 2.2 million households in the first quarter to 2.9 million in the second quarter, which means 3 million households in the United States are now using voice over IP, and the leading provider is Vonage by a large margin. They have about 54% market share, and the closest one behind them is Verizon's. Theirs called VoiceWing and AT&T's, and they have about 5% market share each. Interestingly enough, do any of you guys have this?
No.
I don't. No.
I've played with these
adopters, I wonder.
Well, you know, I think it doesn't make sense when you want a cell phone, because there's your phone right there.
Regardless of, yeah.
And or if you're using DSL, and you have to have a phone number.
All right.
It's kind of like, this is for cable people that want a home phone. And I got to say, my cousin, Greg Trox, was on the show a year ago or something like that. And he, at that time, was running a voice over IP company in Central Valley, California. And we talked a bit about it. And one of the things that I didn't like is, I don't know about you guys, but I rarely lose my phone at home. And I pretty frequently have my DSL modem stop functioning as a gateway to the internet.
Interesting. But it still works as a phone.
Still shows up as a wireless and stuff. No, the phone still works, right? But something's going on with the modem
connection,
where I'm not getting an IP address, or I'm not getting, and then I just have to bounce it. I just have to unplug it and plug it back in, and it comes back online. Not so good with a phone. You know, I'm not online for a day, and I don't happen to not get any phone calls. Well, I'm not getting phone calls because my IP's down. So it's not as stable. It's not, you know, it's not 100 years old like a phone.
I've seen that there are phones out there now that can do VoIP and all the major phone wireless phone networks.
Okay, that's a good.
I think that this is going to be more what's going to be happening, as we see technologies being focused into one unit, and that unit can, or that phone can use any of the technologies to connect. So therefore, you've created an alternate way for it to become more reliable.
And that's a thing that makes a lot of sense. Like when I go into a Wi-Fi area that's got free Wi-Fi, even my home, and I've got a cell phone, wouldn't it be great if that was using voice over IP? Because then I don't have to worry about a tower being near me.
Right.
So, and that's actually when we had the show with Greg Troxell, that's what he was saying to us, is that's the next rev of phones, that they're going to have, you know, the Bluetooth, of course, the Wi-Fi enabled, and the Wi-Fi is going to be able to connect through to voice over IP, and it will all be built into the phone.
But it can fall back to,
It's roaming to wireless points, which is, you know, the holy grail in some degree. Because I'm around that more than a good cell phone coverage. Go on.
The research says that, interestingly enough, more than 27% of the subscribers cited network quality as their primary reason for switching.
Really?
And I can sympathize. My cell phone is horrible quality. It drops calls constantly. The coverage flakes in and out while I'm standing still. It's completely aggravating.
I agree. It's very aggravating. But these people are not switching from cell phones to voice over IP, or are they?
Not part of the survey, but it's interesting that was the primary reason versus cost.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have my experience with good phone coverage from being in Central Coast of California. I don't know how the phone coverage is in other states. There might be areas where the phone coverage is so bad that the systems are down all the time and the actual phone is really unreliable. In that case, the cable company is doing really great on broadband, and so you've got a really good internet connection. That makes sense to me. It depends on region.
I think the point of the story is that think of the millions of dollars that have been invested in the infrastructure by both the plain old telephone system folks and the wireless, your regular cell phone providers. Uh-huh. And there's a massive migration to this new technology that's leaving them in the dust. And it's a cutting edge, early adopter piece.
I wouldn't be surprised if cell phone growth is more than 300 million or 3 million a year.
Boy, I bet. I don't know. I would bet that penetration in the United States is pretty high. Most people who have the ability have a cell phone, probably not two or three. Possibly, but...
But they all buy the newest contract every 3 years, or 1 to 3 years. So you see a lot of... I mean, there's a lot of money going on in the cell phone industry still. I don't think this is even touching it.
Well, they just lost 1 million people, according to this.
Yeah, well, then again, you're assuming those people also don't have a cell phone, which they might. I mean, John right now has two cell phones on him. So,
yeah, but John's a geek, and he doesn't have voice over IP.
The thing that's really intriguing about voice over IP that was fun, when we had that show, and one of us should look up the show number on the site and link to it from this page, Miles. But when Greg was here, he brought one of his phones from his office, and he plugged into the local network here his phone, and all of a sudden he was getting phone calls for his office because he moved locations. Now, the phone didn't work wirelessly. You had to plug into it, but it was kind of neat to be able to see the portable, very stable phone, like a voiceover, like a normal phone, but portable.
Well, folks have been talking about that technology anyway, sure. Like phones that actually will have Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
So if you are near a hotspot, then it switches over to VoIP automatically, and when you're away from that, it's...
As long as it's a seamless transition between the two.
Yeah, it would definitely need to be that.
Yeah, it needs to be transparent.
Thank you, Drew. Thank you, Drew, for that story about voice over IP. Miles, I'd like to jump back to you. What's your next topic for us?
There is a new world's fastest car, it appears. This is a car that is called, I'm not sure if it's Barabbas or Barabbas, but the TKR, it's 1,005 horsepower, completely made in a carbon fiber, or at least the body is, and sells for about $500,000, goes from 0 to 60 in 1.67 seconds.
Wow. That's gonna hurt. Seconds. You better have your head against the headrest on that.
With a top speed of, reportedly, of 270 miles per hour.
Say how this car is powered? Is this the Tesla car that I just saw flash by in the headlines?
No, the Tesla car is an electric car.
Yeah.
So what's this?
This one is...
Your old petrol.
Jet engine.
Yeah, it's a good old petrol, probably a 10-cylinder. No, it's a... Sorry. 6.0-liter V8, twin-turbocharged, with dual intercoolers.
Ooh.
So, Miles,
almost
you're not,
as fast as
you're
your PC, Miles.
Miles, you're not necessarily a car buff. What intrigues you?
Well, it's the world's fastest car.
What's its top speed again? Metric?
In metric.
No. In miles, please.
You know, when I started doing Geek Speak, I guess we started doing it about 5 years ago and took it over from the people from Cruise Isle. When I started doing it, one of the things that was stuck in me is that we are geeks. We're going to move the metric system. I'm not going to use this old, English system. It's horrible.
434 and a half miles per hour.
So how many kilometers?
I'm sorry, 434 and a half kilometers per hour.
Thank you.
For our listeners in the continent.
Well, for anybody, metric is so much better. We're just ignorant people that we don't use it. And I honestly
don't use
it.
Our just depends if you're not moving on the surface of the planet Earth and accounting for... variations in the Earth's spin. So we're not even being accurate there. I mean, come on.
Boy, this is a rat hole. You start
going full speed at this car and suddenly the time's off. Someone who's measuring is different from you in the car.
I know. It's true.
Pretty soon you're driving into the last week.
It's all relative.
Thanks, Miles, for the fastest car in the world.
Speaking of space.
Yes.
Nice.
I've got an update on Cassini. Everyone remembers Cassini. It was launched in 1997.
It was deep space probe, wasn't it?
No, it's one we sent around Saturn.
Mm.
It's a big planet with the rings. You may have seen
it. It's funny. I think of Saturn as deep space, but you're right. Technically, it's not. So it's around. It's taken those pictures of Saturn.
We've only got one craft in deep space right now. That's Voyager. So.
Which isn't telling us anything at this point, right?
They've reestablished communication with it.
When did we launch Voyager?
Really? Yeah.
1970-something.
Yeah, they've been getting...
6, 78, somewhere in there.
A year or so ago, I remember they were getting faint things from Pioneer.
It's shouting back towards Earth, hoping someone can...
It's cold.
Well, Pioneer, the Voyager probes have passed the heliopause now.
Which is the radiation from the sun?
It's when the sun reaches a certain age and starts to have hot flashes. And
it's where the solar wind meets the galactic wind.
So there's a neutral...
So imagine a boat in water, and you have those ripples of water in front of the boat. The sun does the same thing in the galaxy.
And then there's currents pushing in at the boat, and suddenly the boat stops moving?
No.
Oh. We need a picture.
We need to find out what's going on with Cassini.
Cassini has done... it dropped a probe called the Huygens probe.
Oh, yeah, right. Into the atmosphere.
Okay. Right. That was last year.
Sure.
January of last year. Since then, it's been taking measurements. It's been doing things. And it's found that it rains.
What does it rain?
Methane, they think.
So liquid methane.
Liquid methane.
Wait, where does it rain? Rivers, on the planet? I thought it was a gas giant.
On the surface of the planet. No, this is on Titan, sorry.
Sorry, the moon, okay.
I didn't explain that very well. Yeah, Huygens was dropped onto Titan.
Which is a moon of
Saturn.
Okay.
And they found that there are several Earth-like geological features. There's sand dunes, there's
like
rivers.
Like methane rain.
Exactly.
Just like Earth.
So there's methane sea.
Methane seas, okay.
So it does have very Earth-like features, except the analog for water there is methane.
Wow. And so that means there's an atmosphere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's wow.
Nice.
And
something
clouds.
That's really interesting about there being methane is that is a hydrocarbon, even though it's very cold if it's liquid. But
right. Similar to what the Earth had.
It's an organic
millions
molecule.
Of years ago.
I know, it's an organic molecule. Well, it's an organic molecule because it's got carbon in it. That's
right,
the definition.
Right.
But
it's
still,
organic chemistry. Yeah.
It seems to me kind of interesting. So have we had any posits of like life forms using methane as its base material like we use water?
No.
Is that possible?
Is it possible? Sure, it's possible. We don't know enough about life outside Earth to say what's not possible.
It'd be really cold.
It's got sand dunes. It's got an environment that looks like ours.
They're saying other than the heat, which or lack of heat, it's similar to what they think the Earth was in its primal state.
Cool. All right.
The Earth had methane rain or clouds, maybe?
It had a high instance of methane early on.
High concentration. Okay.
You know, I don't know if that's accurate or not. I don't know if we had a lot of methane.
So as the sun gets older and starts reaching out to almost the orbit of Earth,
we might have to go
maybe
there.
Titan may warm up.
Yeah.
We won't have to worry about.
If Titan warms up, Earth's not doing so hot. Well, it's doing very hot. On to
Drew.
Molten
cinder.
Thank you very much, John.
Makes those laptops seem good. Oh, sorry.
I like having the space perspective. I think you do a great job of keeping us abreast
very
of the, on the space. Drew.
More market statistics. This is kind of interesting. There's a popular new phenomenon called YouTube. I don't know if we've talked about it much here yet.
I think I mentioned it a couple times.
So they've got 20 million visitors in the month of June, a 297% increase from the time period from January. So imagine the steepness of that ramp. 20 million people. I mean, that's more than, I don't know how many people in California, but that's a lot.
There's about 20 million people in the Bay Area.
And that's the increase in a month?
In the increase in 6 months. From January to June, they had a 297% increase.
Okay, here's the thing. They're burning bandwidth like nobody's business. YouTube basically allows you to upload free movies at a certain duration. I think it's 10 minutes. And then you can share it with anyone you want. And you can even embed that movie in your web page. So, the thing that concerns me is that there's no obvious way for them to make money. You can upload for free, you can download for free, and they don't have advertising.
So they have phenomenal growth, but analysts are questioning whether the site can transition from a free service to one that can make money. How is this going to work? How do you feed 20 million people's eyeballs for free?
Right.
That's the bottom line.
The bandwidth assumptions, like analysts I saw, I don't know, 2 months ago about YouTube, is that they're burning $1 million a month in bandwidth. So that's expensive.
They're spending $1 million a month in bandwidth.
If you calculate how much bandwidth they're burning through, it's about $1 million worth of bandwidth a month. And that was 2 months ago, a quote that I heard 2 months ago from analysts. So
the more popular they are, the more it's costing them.
Yeah, exactly. And they've got no way to make money. It's, you know, it's the whole...
The faster the wall approaches.
Well, we lose money on everything, but we're going to make it up on volume. I mean, it just doesn't work. So we'll see. But I think some people assume that they're just hoping to get bought. But Yahoo bought Flickr recently, and Flickr doesn't make a lot of money. And I don't know if they're making money on that or not, but it's definitely been an issue of, great, it's popular and everything, but can you make any money on it?
That's a lot of people visiting one place. Pretty interesting idea.
Virtually visiting one place. And the videos are fun. You know, you got to love the videos.
It says that men are 20% more likely to visit YouTube than women. And people between the ages of 12 and 17 are nearly 1.5 times more likely than the average web user. So there's a pretty specific demographic. Teenage boys.
It's because YouTube rhymes with something else.
And it's YouTube, it's YOUTUBE.com. And if you want to do that with high bandwidth, you might spend the rest of your day watching videos. So be careful. YouTube, and Miles will put it up in a minute because he's being so cool. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivery office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. You can call us right now. Rick Philman's awaiting your calls with questions and comments about technology or anything you want. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can use the internet, go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And if you really want to call, just wait a second and I'll give those numbers again.
KUSP co-sponsors the Cabrillo Festival of Contemporary Music, featuring Maestra Marin Alsop and violinist Leila... I apologize if I'm going to mispronounce this. Leila... Yehoshaphat? Yeah.
Yosefowicz. Maybe it's a good idea to go read it on the KUSP site.
Yosefowicz.
In any case.
Yosefowicz. Celebrating its final week now through August 13th. Tickets at the Santa Cruz Civic box office or online at cabrillomusic.org.
This program is supported by Cruise.io Internet, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxel. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam, John Tracy, Drew Meyer. We're all waiting for your calls and questions about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. And that's in the 831 area code. Or if you're in California listening, you're welcome to give us a call toll-free. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can get into our email queue where we'll be able to spend time researching your question before we actually answer it. The phone number, the email address, or the place to do this, geekspeak.org, which is actually a website, geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us. All right. Let's do another news story as we wait calls coming in. I'm going to go back to Miles. Hi.
Hi. Last week, I talked about the sharpest object ever.
Yes.
Yeah, one atom wide at the tip. Here we have something else that's in that small little world we call quantum. Laser tweezers. Tweezers that you can use to pick up and move around individual atoms.
And we describe them as tweezers because they act like a tweezer does, picking up small things.
Right.
And it's really two laser beams that you're able to trap an item in.
Right. And they were
no way.
To sort and align seven atoms while capturing it on film, presumably from an electron microscope.
Did they use laser camera too?
Wait, how do you capture that on film? Wouldn't the photons?
Electron microscope.
How do you have a camera that's small enough to capture anything?
So you bombard with electrons.
Wouldn't that shift
and
the
then
position
some
of
those,
the atoms?
Yeah. But you know,
but you have tweezers
heavy,
holding
you're talking
them
about
still.
Heavy atoms too.
Yeah, and electrons are nothing compared to a proton, neutron.
Yeah,
electrons are nothing.
This is unbelievable.
Oh, they're blurry images.
We're getting to the point where the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is making pictures difficult.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, when you're talking about seven atoms, you're not talking about a stable universe there.
Miles, what was the effort to line up seven atoms all about?
Yeah, how many joules of power did it take to do this?
Did a wormhole open when that happened?
This.
Well, you guys remember 17 heavy atoms, and I'm not sure what they are. IBM was able to line them and make their logo years ago on a chip.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was
grain of salt.
They don't have anything listed as in terms of how much power they took. But yeah, it was more than...
It was a lab. It was 15 people at least. It was a little bit of work. All right, Gil, if you need tweezers that can really get that splinter out, what lab is that?
This was at the University of Bonn.
What?
Where?
Excuse me?
University
of
Bonn?
University
Who are you calling
of Bonn?
Bonn.
Spell it B-O-N-N
okay.
In Germany?
Yes. Okay. In Germany. All right, thank
Beethoven's
you.
Beethoven's birthplace.
Yeah. Always a wise guy.
It's true. True, you know so much. I didn't know that. All right, we're going to go to Aromos. Bob, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, I was wondering if you could tell me about a problem I'm having with Zone Alarm, and it's the Internet Security Suite.
Sure.
And I've installed it, but it seems to be slowing my programs up.
Yeah, it'll do that.
It'll do that.
Yeah, Miles, do you want to address this? Zone Alarm slowing your machine down?
We have two guys who work for a company who knows exactly what's going on here.
And I have absolutely no idea about Zone Alarm.
Other
than the fact that, in general, when you're looking for things like spyware, viruses, Trojans, things like that, which I'll just call malware, anytime you're making those changes, normally a file is just written to the hard drive. But once you have a thing set up that everything that's written to the hard drive or written to memory is then checked by a program to scan through and read that file again and again, but depending upon which database is going on your system, it's going to slow things down. It's kind of a necessary evil.
John, do you want to add to that?
Is there any way to resolve that?
You can uninstall Zone Alarm.
What are you doing with Zone Alarm, Bob? What's the concern? Just protecting your system?
Yeah, just protecting the system. The anti-spyware, antivirus, blah, blah, blah.
Did you get Zone Alarm as a free trial or something with your router or one of your...
No, I bought it.
You bought it? Okay.
Yeah. The simple fact of the matter is if you have a Windows machine, you can't skimp on things to check out to make sure that things are going to do bad things.
How slow are we talking here, Bob?
Well, I've noticed that on some of the games, they'll like stutter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And you can tell there's something going on in the background.
Are these online games?
No. They're,
okay. I suggest you do this. Just turn off the zone alarm and launch the game again and see if it happens. You should be able to quit zone alarm by just going and disabling it, and it will probably come back on when you reboot.
Right, he was saying it wasn't an online game, though.
That doesn't matter. I mean, just in general, if its zone alarm is doing virus, every time, I mean, it could be scanning cache files of the game.
Sure, it's a real-time scan.
Yeah, if that's what it's doing. You can actually turn off some of the stuff and just be more careful as a user.
Here's another idea. Go download and install at one of the freeware trial versions, like from McAfee or Symantec or something, and see if it does the same thing when zone alarm's turned off. Compare the two.
I have another thing that I found out. IC3.gov. I called last week, but I didn't get to get on.
Uh-huh.
And it's, for phishing. If you get email,
is bad.
Is bad, you're right. You go to that site, and it's the FBI and somebody else that's involved in it. But if you want to, file a complaint or whatever with them. And
what's the site?
IC3.gov.
You're correct.
Okay, thank you very much for that suggestion.
Sure thing.
Thanks, Bob, for the call.
Good luck, Bob. Yeah.
Unfortunately, he was talking about the fact that he was playing a game. Yeah. Otherwise, I would have said, you want to not have that slow down? Get a Mac.
Oh.
But you can't do that on a Mac. You can't play most games on a Mac.
Right.
And I think the other solution, of course, is while you're running a game, when you need a lot of your machine to be responsive and you're not online, well, go ahead and turn off the zone alarm. Get used to turning it on and off because you're technically safe most likely.
There must be a way to configure it too.
Yeah.
To accept certain applications.
Well, yeah, to ignore certain directories and ignore certain executables.
Yeah.
All right, we have from Pacific Grove, Gene, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello there.
Hi, what's your question today, sir?
Let me give you the big question is, does the computer wear out? I got some error messages. I'll give you the one I get a lot that's a baby one called script error.
Okay.
An error has occurred in the script on this page. Sometimes I hit, do you want to keep running it? I hit okay and it goes away.
Right.
Sometimes I have to keep hitting it and leave that site.
Okay, I know the answer to that one. What's your next question?
Next one is, got bigger ones. Mprex has caused error in user.exe. Mprex will now close.
Mprex?
But it didn't, and I had to turn the computer off.
Do you know what Mprex is?
No.
Miles, do you know what Mprex is? Geeks, you know what Mprex is?
Googling, hang on.
All right.
Mprexe.
Okay, while Drew is looking that up, I'm going to answer your question about the script errors.
Uh-huh.
You're using Internet Explorer?
Yes.
Okay. So when you're on a web page that the person coded it so that there's errors in the page, any error that's a JavaScript error will throw this exception and the browser will tell you about it. It's kind of an annoying thing because web pages can be like that all the time, right?
Yeah.
So what the newer browsers have done, including, I think, Internet Explorer's newer versions, is they basically just hide that error from you. They fail silently, and there's like a little notation somewhere, but it doesn't pop up a box.
Yep.
And because you're using Internet Explorer, I would recommend using Firefox instead, using a different browser.
Let me take that back.
Please.
I may not be using Internet Explorer because CompuServe switched to Netscape.
Okay, and so it could be Netscape doing it as well.
Okay.
In general, you can go ahead and choose what browser you want to run on your computer. You simply go to a website, download it, install
really?
It, and then make that the default browser.
Oh, okay.
And any user can do that. Your service provider, like Comcast, for example, will give you a recommendation and stuff, but sometimes they're a little behind the times on the version that they want to use.
Yeah.
So I recommend Firefox, and I recommend restarting it every once in a while because it does have a very aggressive cache, which looks like a memory leak. But in any case, run it for about 4 hours and don't run it longer than that. Restart the browser. But it's Firefox, and you can do it. You can get Firefox by going to Mozilla.com.
Mozilla.com.
John.
So you were asking about an error that
you're
getting?
A system error called Mprex, M-P-R-E-X-E, caused an error on user.x.
Found a Knowledge Base article about this at Microsoft. It's caused by a password that's going bad.
What's it's going bad?
Save. It's
a file.
A file that saves your password list.
Uh-huh.
That's becoming corrupt. The PWL file is corrupt.
Did you upgrade this machine from 95?
This is an original Dell with ME. That's why I'm asking. Is it just because I've also recently when I got this error, it didn't shut down. I had to turn the computer off.
Sure.
And I've had to find out lately, too, that once I'm out of CompuServe, I found out my phone wasn't on.
Oh.
Then I had to turn the computer off.
Yeah.
Right. Start everything
okay.
again.
Okay. This is
what's the
sad, old, tired computer.
That's what it is. Isn't
yeah. What's the solution?
The workaround is to locate and delete or rename your PWL file.
So do a search.
It's usually called username.pwl.
Is it in the system folder?
Or username is what your username is. Locate it in the Windows folder.
But I don't have any password.
You're probably not
file.
Using it.
If you have a Windows account, which you need to log into Windows, you have
no.
a password.
No.
You do. It's just flashing by and you don't see it.
It's all hidden behind it, but it's actually behind. Yeah.
This is a little bit of a, self-surgery. So be careful, and you may want to just consider reinstalling the operating system with something newer, and that'll fix both of those problems.
Well, could I do that, or do I have to go get a new computer?
The computer itself, if you're not hearing any buzzing noises or smoke coming out or it's not getting really hot, then you're probably, it's not a Dell notebook.
I did scan disk, and the scan disk went through and said everything was all right, except it said something, it took a long time because it said something else was running.
Okay.
I'm not running anything, I even turned off the screensaver, and I couldn't find anything running.
There's actually a lot of stuff running in the background all the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't know about it. But so the solution is to go find, it's probably user.pwl.
We'll put this Microsoft Knowledge Base article up on our site. We'll link,
okay,
to
link to it.
Show.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Right.
So visit geekspeak.org, and it talks about exactly how to do that.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Good luck, Gene.
Bye-bye. Oh, Gene,
Bob,
sorry.
Gene, I don't know.
I think it was Gene. Yep. Okay, from Santa Cruz, Anthony, welcome to Geekspeak. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, Anthony.
Yes, hi.
Hi, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question that's it's a little similar to and kind of building on what a couple of callers, the fellow from Aromas, was asking about, the computer running slower and slower. I've been having the same problem with my IBM ThinkPad laptop that I've had for a couple of years, and it's running on a Windows XP platform, and I use it for business applications only, no gaming or videos or anything, complex. But over the last couple months, it started running slower and slower. And what puzzles me is I haven't added any new programs, changed any profiles, and I've run all of my, I've been religious about maintaining, never connecting to the Internet except through a, hardware firewall, through my router, running virus scans and all kinds of malware on a very regular basis. And I've run all of that, and I've done a disk defrag, and it's still running quite slow. So,
and how do you know it's running slower? You can tell, or...
Just everything takes longer to come up.
And how long have you had this box?
About 2 years. I bought it in August 2004, new.
Okay.
And you bought it brand new?
Yeah.
That's about the cyclation process for me. I normally reinstall the OS every year.
So as you use the thing and add programs, remove programs, make changes, etc., it modifies some accounts in a place called the registry.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of a creeping death. Over time, these modifications take longer and longer for the computer to go sort through and find out what the accurate modification for current situation is, and it slows down the box.
Uh-huh.
And that's one example of how it slows down over time.
Yeah, okay, it's one example.
And there's
I never
a zillion
know why
reasons.
It's really doing it. Yeah,
just that, if you'll tolerate my terminology, the virtual enema is the solution. And, that'll make a world of difference for this machine.
Okay.
It's interesting because we have a lot of answers on GeekSpeak, but the truth is all of us that have Windows machines have to reinstall it once in a while because of this problem of the machine getting slower and slower. I don't think we have a simple solution except to say chaos theory is, pretty functional.
Yeah.
And it's a compliment. It means you're really using your box. It means you're pushing it. You're making stuff happen. In geek world, it's a badge of pride.
It's not a
That's
fun thing.
That's the explanation. It's the decline in speed has been fairly precipitous over the last couple of months, and before that, it was, I would say, running just as fast as ever.
That's a little bit of
not been a slow, steady decline. It's been like, wow, it's really running slow now.
You might have a virus.
Well, you sound like you're pretty disciplined about the maintenance tasks.
Rick has a good question. How much drive space do you have available?
How would I figure that out?
You could right-click on the C drive and get properties on it. It'll show you a little pie chart there.
Okay.
When you last defragmented, did it give you any messages about there's no space left to defragment, you have to delete some stuff first?
No, I didn't get a message like that. I ran the defrag about a week ago. And, okay, so let me, if I right-click on the C drive, properties. Yeah. Let's see what I got here.
Tick through and add up a bunch.
Oh, yeah, okay. There's very little free space.
That's why. You need to have at least 10% of your drive free for it to be able to do paging. So thanks, Rick, for that one.
Rick Philman, our phone answerer, nailed that
one. And Geek, yeah, way beyond phone answerer.
No, he
pulled one out of the hat. Way to go, buddy.
Most of the time I want to get him in here, but of course then people couldn't call in.
So that's the A number one choice of things to address.
Okay. Okay.
Get rid of either delete some of the big files you have there, or migrate them somewhere else, or add a new hard drive or another hard drive, or replace the drive you have.
Okay.
Do something about that storage space.
Okay. All right.
And that'll make a
huge
difference.
And as far as reinstalling the whole operating system,
it can't hurt, but there's some amount of pain that goes with that. You lose all your settings. You got to reinstall all your applications.
If you feel like you want to get a larger hard drive, this is a perfect opportunity to get a larger hard drive, reinstall all your operating system on the large hard drive. You've solved everything at once, and your machine's going to be running sweet again.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you so much for the call.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
That one.
Way to go, Rick.
Yeah, I think that's a slam dunk. Great question, Rick.
Yep. All right, so you're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Rick Philman's taking phone calls. You're welcome to call in with questions and comments about technology, 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or you can call us on the 800 line, 1-800-655-KUSP. And we're going to go ahead and take Sue from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Sue.
Hi. I have an employer-owned old EMAC that I want to recycle. They want it back.
Do you work for education?
What?
Do you work in the education field?
Yes.
Okay. Go on.
And I want to ensure there are a lot of computers that get stolen out of locked offices up there. And I'm wondering if there's any way I can erase the hard drive myself here before I give it back. I have a FireWire cable, and I have another computer here. I don't have a password to do things on these hard disks.
You don't have a password?
You're not an administrator.
No.
Yeah.
Well, your user account, you have access to delete everything of your user account.
All you need an OS X CD. You can drop an OS X CD in there, and you can reset the account.
That's kind of hacking through being the admin and stuff. You don't need to do that.
What's the concern, Sue? Is there something on there that you really want to keep and don't want to share?
Confidential information of mine and my employer's, and I trust the people immediately involved. I trust their intentions, but sometimes doors get unlocked and things take time. You know,
we'll
eventually erase it up there. But
first off, this is pretty important. There's court cases where employees have erased content on computers and they've been taken to court for it. So first, get an approval that it's okay to do this.
Oh, there's no content that I don't have on the other computer. It's all
okay. So what you're going to do is you log in. Are you running OS X? Or is it older, like OS 9? Do you know?
10.
Okay. So in that, you have an account that you log in with all the time. For that account, all the documents that you write using that account, you have the ability to erase.
Okay.
So what you want to do is you want to go in and erase manually your desktop and your documents and everything inside these spaces. And then inside a folder called library inside your user folder, there's a folder in there and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. There's probably a cleaning application that does this manual, you know, automatically, but you can just do it manually. Just go in and erase things that denote personal information or information you want to erase. Like inside your mail client, there'll be a folder called mail, and you want to delete that, depending on what you use. And you're just going to go through and erase things, and once you've done that, you want to do a secure empty trash can. And that's it.
So keep in mind here, Sue, that in the storage industry, our mantra is that no disk is ever erased unless you've put a drill bit through it.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of dropping it in the bathtub.
That certainly won't hurt it.
If it's still working,
might hurt your bathtub.
Passing large magnets around it.
Yeah, I think something for you, Lyle, actually, is because I don't know. What is secure erase trash can?
I don't know. I think it mixes up the bits when it erases. It, like, rewrites.
No, I mean, like, where do you
Is there
get
such
there?
A choice?
Oh, sorry.
What?
I think it's just a normal choice.
So, Sue, Lyle just mentioned this command called secure erase trash can, which is different than regular.
And I'm insane and it doesn't exist. Is that what you're saying, Miles?
Yes. Something like that. I'm like, what is this? Well, this is new. I want to find out.
Open terminal and do rm-rf.
No, that's friend Alex making a Unix joke about it.
Yeah. No, you can do that, but you need to log on. And it's not really going to erase it.
And then that's one simple answer. I mean, that's one of the answers. The next thing that you want to do to be more secure is you talk to the people that actually have the permissions to do things on this computer, the administrators of this computer,
and say, well, just send it up here. We'll do it. And I'm sure they will, but I don't know when and how many unlocked offices it will sit in until they get to it.
Well,
you're a very conscientious employee. That is award-winning behavior.
I think what you should do is walk that up there with them and say...
I can't lift it.
Well, but okay. I mean, when you give it to them, stay with it until they erase it.
Well, that's an idea.
Just say, you know, I want this thing wiped, and you need to do that. And what they'll probably want to do anyway is install the OS on it again and just say, you know, I don't want to be a jerk about this, but this is the way we need to do this because this is personal information. It's my responsibility, and if I let it go to somebody else, I'm not doing my duty as an employee or as a moral person. And just, you know, bring them brownies at the same time, and you're set.
Okay, so it's user library erase, and then stick in, you could stick in the operating disk?
Yeah, if you put an operating disk in, you can become the administrator.
Okay, great. I think.
Okay, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Sue. All right, from Big Sur, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello there.
Hiya.
Question about a professional program to store, file, access digital images, photographs.
You want a digital asset management application?
Yes, but I want some that, you know, can handle a lot of items as a professional level software can, but I want something that's user friendly.
Okay. Well, we have an answer for you. Geeks.
Great.
Who is the best search engine technology company in the world?
Google.
And they have a program called Picasa that several of us have already recommended in answer to your question here talking to each other.
Well, I've heard of Picasa, but I didn't imagine it would be robust enough.
How many files do you have?
I don't have so many right now, but I just want to do this one time and for the long term.
Are you a professional photographer? Is your livelihood dependent on this?
I'm just getting into that right now, and I'm setting up a website and doing the files.
Okay, well, I think on a Windows environment, the best free application is Picasa. The application that I personally use is called iMatch by Photo Tools. The word phototools.com without the extra, it's like phototools.
Oh, without the O after the photo?
Yeah, you like merge the two words together. Yeah, and they have it's a one developer guy, and the app has an application called iMatch, and it's really great.
iMatch.
Now, its interface is kind of cool because you can do some scripting and stuff. The other one that's got a great interface that you can spend money on is called iView, and iView, I think, is a great application. We've had an author on for digital asset management a while back on the show, and he recommends that application, and it's
now,
really good.
Are we talking about a Mac or a PC?
PC.
So, Lyle, those two are both Mac programs,
actually,
right?
iMatch is flavored? PC only, and iView is both.
Cool. Now, so there's two choices for you.
But Picasso's great, too. Now, with all that said, Picasso does not do digital asset management. It does. There's two different kinds of flavors of photo management. One is you have a thing that just reads what you have on your computer. So it doesn't do anything about managing the files. It doesn't do backup. It doesn't do like an archiving system. It just kind of reads what's in the folder system. So if you go into that folder and you erase the file, it's gone.
Right.
That's Picasa does that. It just looks at the file system. And Adobe Bridge, which is part of the CS2 Adobe suite, does that. iMatch and iView both create libraries and actually understand it from a database perspective. They have a copy of the image to some degree and they do backup and stuff.
Okay.
So I personally would try Picasa because it's free and it's really good, and start using it and see how it goes. There's a large growth rate. They develop the machine and add features to that application all the time. And if you run into something you just can't do, take a look at those other two applications.
So it's Picasa, P-I-C-A-S-A. Just go to Picasa.com. It'll take you right to the Google site.
Go to geekspeak.org. It'll be up on the show page.
Geekspeak.org.
Okay, now I do have a question about iView and iMatch.
Okay.
Do both of those have customer service support?
iView, yes. How's that? iMatch has a discussion board with a lot of people featuring, and the one developer that actually writes the application answers questions.
Okay.
But his fix duration is pretty long. It takes a while for him to come up with a new patch.
Right.
iView is a full applications. I mean, it's a full company. It's got a lot of tech support people, and yes, they do have it. And they have multiple versions of the application. So I think if you want to have a good customer service relationship experience, go ahead and go to iView. Thank you so much for the call.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Right on. Some interesting questions today.
Definitely. You listen to Geek Speak, the geeks of the room, Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, John Tracy. I'm Lyle Troxell. We're taking your calls and questions and comments about technology. I think we're going to take this last call right now, and that'll probably be the last call for the day. But please, Ted, tell us what the problem is in Santa Cruz.
Hi, Ted.
Hi, Ted.
Greetings.
Hello.
Ted.
Hi, what's up?
Hi, well,
I've got about a 5-year-old Windows 2000 box, and a couple weeks ago, it just crawled to a stop. It still boots. I can log in, but literally it takes 5 minutes to open a folder.
Sounds like you're infected with something.
What's that?
Sounds like it's infected with something.
Or as Rick Filmman would say, the hard drive might be full.
Or the hard drive.
No, I think I've got room on the hard drive. No, but when I looked at the task manager, actually in the processes, well, the task manager performance, the CPU is pegged at 100%.
And this is before you've done anything.
Right.
What process, if you look under processes,
right, the process is called services.exe, which upon Googling, I found 4 viruses that mimic that piece. So
it's like the best name you could think of for a virus process.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I think there is a process called services.exe.
Well, there is, exactly.
And it actually manages things on 2000.
Services.
Doesn't peg the CPU like
that. But it is possible that you've got like a web server running as one of the services, and it's the one that's doing all the process. But like,
well, no, I think it's a virus.
If I had to bet something.
Hang on. There's a Microsoft Knowledge Base on here, article that talks about this on specifically Windows 2000 machines.
Uh-huh.
Do you have the latest service pack on that?
Yes, I do keep it.
Oh, well, that's less likely then.
Yeah.
Never mind.
So it does seem like a virus. And I have not been able to boot into safe mode. It's like it's somehow disabled the F8. Functionality.
This really does sound like a virus.
When I put in the OS CD and I press any key to boot from CD, that also doesn't work.
Okay, well that's not.
That's something else.
That's something else going on.
That's something else going on.
I guess if you're getting into the virus, unless you boot the machine. So here's the deal.
Drive.
What you can do is not even touch the hard drive and touch the CD first. Especially if you don't care about what's on the computer, you just want to reinstall the OS. This is how you do it. You have to go into the BIOS of the computer. Normally, it's delete key when you boot.
Or F8. He's right.
Okay. No, that's going to Windows prompt. And so if his Windows is totally corrupt, you can't get into that. You've got to get into the BIOS first.
Oh, I. So see then the delete key gets into CMOS.
That's the BIOS.
Which is the boot CMOS. Order.
Yeah, exactly. Change the boot order. Put the CD at the top. Put your CD back in, and
sometimes you can take all the bootable devices out except for that CD, and then you know for sure.
Right.
You're only booting from the CD.
But be careful to still detect your hardware so the CD can actually see the hard drive. So, yeah, the boot order you can arrange and everything. If the CD's in there and the CD's good, it'll boot from that first, and that's the way to go. Oh, and the CD might still say hit a key to boot from the CD, depending on what version of the CD it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then that one, though, it's that CD that's controlling it, not the OS.
Right.
So you do that, you shouldn't get the CPU peg problem, and that'll help you diagnose.
Thank you, Ted, so much for the call.
Can I ask one quick follow-up? I know we're out of time.
Sure, you can ask it. You can ask it. Go ahead.
Okay. In calling around about this, one place I talked to railed about how bad Norton antivirus is and Symantec and said it's bad code and can even harm OS X Max. And
who was this?
Should I say?
Sure.
E=mc².
Okay.
There.
I probably would trust them, but we have to go, and I can't say anything more. So thank you so much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And this is, the end of Geek Speak, as it is every week at 11. But do stay tuned, of course, for Castle Cottage coming up next. Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were John Tracy, Drew Meyer, and Miles Elam. Geeks, thank you so much for being here today with me.
Pleasure to be here.
With all of us.
And Rick.
And I want to mention a special thanks to Rick, who answers the phones every week religiously. He's been doing it for about a year. Happy anniversary, Rick. Thank you so much for being on Geek Speak to support us every week, answering calls and questions about technology. And thank you also for, of course, getting us back on track and answering technology calls today. thank you for listening to Geek Speak. For those that called in, thanks for making Geek Speak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at kosp.org. For KOSP and for Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell.